Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Sutter of the Democratic World Federalist, member of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. We welcome any viewers or listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Is this coming through all right? We're pleased to have Andres Bummel as today's speaker at the Commonwealth Club. He flew in from Berlin just last Friday. Andres was born in Cape Town, South Africa. But back in Germany, he studied business administration in Frankfurt am Main, the financial capital of Europe. And more recently, he has majored in international public law at the University of Mainz. Mainz, as you know, is where Johannes Gutenberg invented the printing press with mobile type, thus making it possible not only for the clerical and aristocratic 1% of their era to be literate and to know what was going on in the world, but also for us ordinary people, the masses, and the rising middle class. This invention contributed to the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Age of Enlightenment. Since 1998, Andres has been advisor of the Society for Threatened Peoples, a major human rights organization. In recent years, he's been active in the Freie Demokratische Partei, Germany's liberal party, but he tells me he left it last year. In 1997, I had the pleasure of meeting Andres in Montreux, Switzerland, when he represented German World Federalists at the 50th anniversary of the founding of the World Movement for World Federal Government, now called World Federalist Movement. And between 1998 and 2000, we were both members of that global body's governing council. Andres has long been concerned with the democratic deficit in the United Nations. In 1998, he founded the Committee for Democratic United Nations Organization, CADUN, and through it, in 2007, he started an international campaign for the establishment of a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly, the UNPA. Today, he will speak on a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly and global democracy. Join me in welcoming Andres Bummel.
Thank you very much, John, for this very nice introduction. I am very, very pleased to be here today. John just mentioned it, that we've known each other for more than 15 years now, so it's a special pleasure. And also because, obviously, in San Francisco, the United Nations was established in 1945. So I think it's just appropriate to address the question of how to reform and democratize the UN exactly in this city today. And I'm very pleased that I can present to you the campaign for a UN Parliamentary Assembly in a broader context of the question regarding the question, what does democracy mean in times of globalization, actually? I think that's the main question we have to ask ourselves. And I've prepared some slides for you. We will look into what a UN Parliamentary Assembly is supposed to be formally, you know, technically, but also the ramifications, the impact of that. And I think that's the important thing, because it's not about establishing some new body, some bureaucracy, but it's about the impact we expect this body to have in the long run on international law, with regard to developing world law and to reforming and transforming the UN. One of the basic trends that is extremely relevant in this context, that is democratization in general. This trend is prevalent for the last 100 years, even longer, which means if you look at history in the long run, you will see that in 1900 there was not a single country in the world that was truly democratic, meaning allowing for universal suffrage. You know, not only men, not only the haves, you know, those with access to money, but universal suffrage. So it only developed very, very slowly, but it is indeed a trend that cannot be denied. You can see here in this graphic the development of different types of government in the world, in the community of states. And there is an obvious trend. You see, during the Cold War, there was a high rise of autocracies in the world. And since 1919, approximately, there's a real downfall. I know that just recently people are, you know, saying that there is a backlash in democracy, but I would argue exactly contrary to that. Just look at what has been happening in the Arab world. You know, the real push for democracy in the Arab world, and we are all aware that there are complexities and problems involved with this. But even here and in other countries, you know, establishing a sound system of democratic government has taken a long time. And in the Arab world, you know, it will also take a long time. But nonetheless, I would say we can interpret it in a way that this long-term trend towards democratic governance at the national level is sustained. And it's still happening. The point I want to make is something different. And in 1990, as you might know, people like Francis Fukuyama, they said, you know, we are at the end point of history as the model of a liberal democracy, you know, has actually, there is no alternative any longer. But this is, in a way, getting it wrong if you look at the process of evolution overall, of socio-political evolution, because we can identify different levels of socio-political evolution with the development of different levels of governance. So if we say the end point of, you know, the development is reached, that can, at best, and I doubt it, be said at the national level. Because if we look at how interconnected our world has become, and this is just a simplification, of course, we will discover that the issues, the major issues the world is faced with, have become global, which is the largest possible, socio-political level of development on Earth, as long as we do not discover aliens, you know, and galactic, if you like, contact. But the Earth level is the largest we have. And even in the 1970s, you might be aware that, you know, we have the development of the theory of Gaia, that Earth is so highly interconnected that one can almost call it a, you know, an organism. And in the 60s already, Marshall McLuhan, he coined the term of the global village. And even this is 50 years ago. And where are we now with the development of internet? So it is undeniable that we have a so interconnected world that what we need is actually genuinely global kind of governance. But that doesn't exist. We do have a governance vacuum at the global level because we don't have genuinely global institutions to deal with global problems, to put it, you know, easily. If you look at the Rio plus 20 development, you can just see why that is the case. The UN, the WTO, IMF, Rio plus 20 process are processes that are run by national governments, and the very purpose of national governments, that's why they are there, is to represent national interests, or what they define as being national interests, because that is also a point of debate, of course, what that actually is, national interests. In my view, national governments, in a way, have become a soulless, empty shell that is being hijacked, if you like, by vested interests. And one of the reasons why that is possible is because of this vacuum at the global level. So, related to this is a democratic vacuum. The democratic vacuum means that, at least at the international level, we do have institutions in place that coordinate national governments, but we do not have any institutions in place that actually represent the people, which is a big difference. So, we do have global problems, but we don't have genuinely global institutions And we do not have institutions at the international and the global level at all, and let alone democratic. You will see in this chart the three different columns. And the point I will be talking about is the parliamentary representation of citizens. And there is a very, very interesting trend that is being overlooked by science and political observers at this level. And I will come to that right now in more detail at the regional level. We do have in all parts of the world socio-political processes going on of integration, which means ever closer coordination of national governments and of with different types of goals, which means that one of the first goals might be to have preferential trade agreements. This is also going on at the international level, to have free trade areas, custom unions. This is something that political scientists have worked out as the modern type of integration, because there is one very important point today, by contrast to the time before nuclear power was developed, because it is no longer possible to solve conflicts at the international level between the big powers by force, simply because they possess nuclear weapons, which means that they can destruct each other completely. So there needs to be a different process of integration and of resolving conflicts. And at the regional level, political scientists say this is what is happening. And I just want to stress again, because often people just think of the European Union. But of course, because the European Union, it has its problems, but the European Union is of the most developed of these processes. But let me stress, it's going on everywhere. In South America, for example, there is the goal of establishing a joint federated state with a common currency, with a common parliament, and so on. So this is interesting. It's happening also in Africa. There's the African Union. There's the goal of establishing a joint African currency. So we are not only talking about Europe. But, of course, in Europe, the development, as I said, is most advanced. And just in these days, we are witnessing very, very, dramatic things going on, negotiations going on, because what has happened in Europe, and that's a very interesting, point that can be learned in other regions now. In Europe, a monetary union was established before a real political union was there, meaning a fiscal union, a banking union, joint fiscal control. So actually, the monetary union, the question now is, I would say, whether monetary union and political union would have to go together, and that not happened in Europe. And I believe that in the end, we will probably see, or will have to see, if the euro is to be saved, the development of a European federal state, just as it has happened, in the United States. In the regions, there is a strong movement towards including citizens in negotiations in the formal bodies, in the formal organizations, which means that there is already a process going on of establishing supranational democracy. In Europe, again, we are most developed in the world. It is most developed in the world because there is the European Parliament, and you need to be aware that the European Parliament by now, through the Lisbon Treaty that was adopted a couple of years ago, is in some respects even more powerful than many of the national assemblies in Europe. It's a real powerhouse. It's no longer a talking shop. And we have similar processes going on in other regions. There's the Pan-African Parliament, the Parliament del Mercosur, which is that South American Free Trade Union that is now also developing a kind of political union. And in many of these cases, these parliaments are the driving forces of integration and also the driving forces of making sure that the institutions that are built and that are in place are accountable and representative. The point is, although there are more and more international bodies dealing with major international issues, there's not a single parliamentary body of these organizations at the international level. It doesn't exist. This is quite noteworthy, because is the principle of having democratic representation at the regional level in intergovernmental organization is accepted, then why is it not accepted at the level of, which is even more important, at the level of global institutions? Just let me remind you of the UN system, which is so complex, which has such a, you know, in some parts of the world, such an influence and impact on the daily lives of people. And there's no possibility to take influence except through the foreign ministries, through the bureaucracy. There are no real representatives existing at none of those institutions. At the WTO, there are none. At the International Monetary Fund, that, by the way, has a dramatic influence on national policy. Just let me give you one example. The transitional government in Egypt had negotiations going on with the IMF even before the new parliament was elected. So is a treaty, or I mean an agreement, would have come out of that. The new freely elected democratic Egypt would have been bound by that treaty without even, you know, the citizens in a direct way having a say in it, and without having an influence on the IMF's, you know, the IMF's, it's, how would you call that? It's conditions. So the point is that these liberation and democracy movements, they at some point will recognize that it is not much value to have, you know, established democratic institutions at the national level alone, as long as international institutions remain undemocratic. What some philosophers are doing is they are calling it the third democratic revolution we are now dealing with, which is imminent. The first of this would have been the development of city-states 500 before Christ. You know, of course, we are aware it's problematic, it's been problematic. Only 20% of people would have been, you know, in a position to actually raise their voice and decide in the city councils. But nonetheless, it was the first attempt of establishing some kind of democratic kind of governance. And then the second revolution, democratic revolution, well, is so closely in, you know, connected with what has happened in America, the American Revolution, the American independence, and of course the French Revolution. And at that time, you know, people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, they argued, look, we have a Greek example, but you know, something like democracy simply cannot develop in a, you know, a large territorial state. That's impossible. But reality has proved him wrong. And we are at a you know, kind of same position today, as many people argue, look, yes, it has developed democracy at the territorial state, you know, at the level of the territorial state, but forget it, it can never happen at the global scale. So it is going to happen, probably. And it has been already mentioned, as I am coming from Mainz, the important impact of the, you know, printing press on sweeping away the feudal lords. And in the same way, some people argue that the development of the internet is contributing to overcoming, you know, the predominance of nation states and national governments on international governance. So what we are talking about is cosmopolitan democracy, actually, which is imminent. The core dysfunction of the UN, I already mentioned, is the fact that it is actually driven by the national governments, and the national government's purpose is to represent national interests, and that's fine. There is no problem in that. But we have some, I mean, in principle, if it is, you know, and I will talk about that more, if it is complemented by other interests. But the point I want to make here is that the number of UN member states in the context of decolonization and so on has grown and grown and grown all the time, which means that by now, if we look at the UN General Assembly, which is the main deliberative organ of the UN, if we look at the share of votes, and the 100, I mean, this is, of course, only numerically, you know, mathematically, but nonetheless, it shows what we are dealing with. The 128 least populous states that represent 8.4% of the world's population have more than two-thirds of the votes, which means that is no wonder, from my point of view, why large countries go to, you know, they establish forums like the G20, the G8, and other things to circumvent this, because not only is the UN General Assembly totally ritualistic and, you know, bureaucratic, but it is also extremely dominated by very, very small states who in some you know, respects are even fictional because they are so small. Here's another slide to show that. The two-third majority of votes, 11% of world's GDP, and only 8.4% of the world's population. And I would like to ask you, is that democratic? I mean, in principle, if such a body would, you know, adopt world law, you know, because it would mean that, I mean, in theory, I'd like to stress this is, of course, only a model to make the point. But nonetheless, if 8.4% of the world's population can make binding world law, that's, of course, not something we would agree with, I guess. So what's the main challenge is, how can we change, how can we, you know, get away from that status quo? How can we actually facilitate the third democratic revolution? What vehicle is there to do that? And that is the vision of a world parliament. And interestingly, we are not dealing with a new idea. We didn't reinvent the wheel. We just try to get it moving, that wheel, you know. So the idea of a world parliament already existed at the very beginning of the so-called second democratic revolution. At the time of the French Revolution, there were French revolutionaries, and at the beginning there was a very strong cosmopolitan drive in the French Revolution, who said, we do need a world parliament, and the French Revolution should be a universal revolution to overcome, you know, feudalism and to overcome the monarchs. We know it happened differently, but I just wanted to say it's a very old idea. So it is now being, you know, redeveloped in the context of our times. The goal, I would say, which exists in this context, if we talk about a cosmopolitan revolution, is to complement international law with world law, which means to have, and I mentioned those socio-political levels of development, to have a legal system that is based genuinely at the global level. And this means that the main blocks are the citizens in a cosmopolitan system. We all are world citizens, and we all should have the same vote. It raises the question, do we take it seriously that all people in the world have an equal value? Do we take that seriously? If we do take it seriously, we will have to spell it out. I mean, then we will have to go down the whole road and bear the consequences, which would mean, in the end, that every human being would have to have the same voice and the same vote in electing a world representative body. And in Europe and elsewhere where we are talking about this, people always say, oh my God, then we would be dominated by the Indians and the Chinese and so on. But think about it. It might be true, yes. There are lots more of Chinese and Indians than, like, Americans, Germans, whatever. But nonetheless, in consequence, if we think it through unconsciously, what we are saying is they are less equal than we are. They have less value than we. And that's why we don't want them to have the same vote. And that's something, in principle, that we have to think about, really. So if we say the building block are citizens, it has dramatic ramifications. Then the paradigm is not national independence and sovereignty, which is a fiction anyway. Just think about how the Chinese government holds U.S. debt. Then the paradigm here would be global interdependence. World law would supposed to be universal, no loopholes, binding quite everyone, not only states, but also citizens. And I mean, this is ideal. You know, just don't think this is what we want to achieve tomorrow. I just want to show where I believe the development will go to. At the international level, who represents us? Well, only indirectly mediated through the appointees by the executive branch, who are in most cases technocrats who are not interested in, you know, pursuing the common well-being, but in pursuing vested interests. By contrast to that, in a system of world law, I would expect that the representatives would be elected by the world's citizens. And the rulemaking body in this case would be a world parliament and not some opaque, intransparent intergovernmental negotiations. I don't know whether you have heard of ACTA, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement that was negotiated over the past 4 years. At the beginning, in complete secrecy, nobody knew what was going on. In fact, except those who were directly involved. And this is really remarkable, national parliaments all over the world whose governments were involved in the negotiations were not informed what was going on. They were expected to, adopt the outcome in the end. And that's what's happening. And there are just a few exceptions, like the U.S. Congress, I have to say, of parliaments who are in a position to actually reject a treaty that was negotiated in such a way. But that's a real exception. Think about small countries and their parliaments. They cannot, put at play the position of their government at the international. They just have to, ratify whatever comes, what the government has negotiated. So one of the most important points is this, in the end. What are we talking about? At the international level, at the level of international law, states pursue the raison d'état, the national interest, or what the government says is the national interest. But in a system of world law, we would have, for the first time, real entities, a world parliament, elected representatives, who pursue raison d'humanité, the well-being of all of humanity. And it is no wonder that processes like RioPlus20 go nowhere, because there is no entity in the world that officially represents the common interest of all. It doesn't exist. And as I said before, it is okay if national governments pursue the national interest. That's why they exist, in a way, at that level. But it has to be complemented. There needs to be a counterbalance. And this counterbalance would be created by citizens, representatives directly elected by the citizens. Well, and the vehicle to go into this direction, that's the UN Parliamentary Assembly. So we are not just talking about a formal body, one more of I don't know how many bodies at the UN, but we are talking about the first body in human history, in human evolution, that would establish a direct connection between all of us with the planet. Such a thing doesn't exist. So it has ramifications of, a philosophical kind in all ways. So the purpose of that assembly we are talking about would be to represent the citizens in global governance, and there would be phases of development. And I hinted at that already. We are not expecting such a revolution to take place from today to tomorrow. But we can look at models at the regional level, like the European Parliament, like the Pan-African Parliament and others, how it slowly, in a piecemeal way, went forward. And that's something that is being suggested here as well, which means that a UN Parliamentary Assembly at the beginning could be just an advisory body with no legal power, which is not asking much, actually. It would be a deliberative body. Then, initially, it could be composed of national members of parliament, not directly elected, so which would mean that the U.S. Congress would elect its own members going to this assembly. And later, in later stages, direct elections could take place. Yeah, I talked about that already. Well, just to show this, of course, you cannot look at all these numbers now, but this argument, we would all be dominated by India and China. One of the key things is, and recall the small table about international law and world law, the point is that at the level of world law, at the level of this assembly, there wouldn't even be, nation states represented. The UN Parliamentary Assembly would be composed of individual representatives that would probably group in a political way. We would probably have a conservative group, a socialist group, a green group, and there would not be groupings at international kind. So if such an assembly would take a decision, nobody could say, well, this decision was, adopted without the approval of the United States or without the approval of this and that country, because there are simply no countries in that body existing. We would have cross-border political groups. And I'm showing this to, we have thought through models, and these are just three of a lot of models that exist. And there are different kinds of how the seeds could be apportioned. And also, again, we would have phases of development. At the beginning, it would be the principle of degressive proportionality, which means that small countries would have relatively more seats than large countries per capita. You see, and in the end, although China has like 20% of the world population, in this model they only would have 4.6% of seats, 6%, 10%, and so on. And of course, this is just to illustrate it. There are dozens of models, but I just want to change your mindset that at the beginning, we would most probably not have a body where the seats are apportioned directly proportional to population size. It would be different, and that's exactly how it looks like in the European Parliament. The European Parliament is a good model in many respects because it shows how such a piecemeal approach can actually happen. At the beginning, it was really an assembly, a consultative assembly, around specific issues like coal, steel, nuclear power, and so on. And step by step, while European integration developed, it developed into a real legislative body with direct elections, and it had a very strong impact on actually overcoming deadlocks in the process of European integration. And just remind yourselves of the deadlocks in UN reform that exist. And why is that? Because actually, and that's my personal opinion, I think that the governments represented at the UN, they are all more or less content, satisfied with the status quo. Of course, there's parlance of reform for decades, but there would be, in principle, ways to, go forward with reform even without the approval of the permanent five members on the Security Council, etc. And I believe that a parliamentary assembly that would be composed by elected representatives could really reinvigorate the whole discussion on UN reform and put some weight behind new initiatives. So a UN parliamentary assembly would really be a catalyst for global change. It would represent us, it would bring in the cosmopolitan ideas, it would be a first step in developing world law. And this actually amounts, let me go through this quickly, because we had that. This would actually amount to a new global social contract. And this is something that is being promoted by Jürgen Habermas, Ottfried Höfer, and others, which would mean that if something like a reformed and transformed UN is to be developed, it should actually rest on two pillars. And these pillars, as I put it, are the system of international law as we know it. It wouldn't be abolished, it would still exist. But on top of that, complementary, we would have a system of world law. And these are the two pillars of a new global social contract, namely the world citizens and the nation states as we know it, which would amount in the end to a global bicameral legislative system composed of an assembly that represents the states and an assembly that represents the citizens who would, in a complicated, probably, balanced manner together, adopt decisions. If we look at the past, we will see that innovations in international law and in the global system, unfortunately, and most of the times, only occurred after very, very dramatic and terrible events. The principle of national sovereignty, which is one of the building blocks of international law, was only reluctantly accepted after the 30 Years' War. The League of Nations, the first step in actually establishing collective security, establishing, that the so-called sovereign entities are bound by common rules, only developed after the First World War, and the United Nations only after the Second World War. And I will ask yourself, all of you, are we to wait for a new catastrophe until we actually get to the step, to the point of developing world law and a transformed UN and a new world organization? I hope not. After all, we are equipped with reason, We can decide what to do. It is in our hands. And let me close with a quote by Václav Havel, who was one of the supporters of the campaign for a UN Parliamentary Assembly. I will simply read it. I think it's very good. That's why I chose it, of course. The salvation of this human world lies nowhere else than in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human humbleness, and in human responsibility. With a global revolution in the sphere of human consciousness, nothing will change for the better in the sphere of our being as humans, and the catastrophe towards which this world is headed, whether be it ecological, social, demographic, or a general breakdown of civilization, will be unavoidable. And note that he said that in 1990. The clock is running, and I hope that we will engage in a common struggle. Thank you.
Our thanks to Andreas Bummel for his talk on the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly and Global Democracy. We'd like to remind our audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and I'm John Sutter, member of the International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. Herr Bummel will now take questions, and they're in the process of being collected, so just a moment. Okay, we'll start off with a very simple question. There would be direct elections by whom? Man, woman, children?
Well, I mean, this is the ideal endpoint of the development, and in this case, I would say, of course, direct elections by universal suffrage worldwide. So this has, of course, ramifications on national democracy as well, because we are all well aware of the fact that in some countries, and I showed the figures, you know, in some countries there is not even a kind of democratic governance in place at the national level. But calling for, you know, direct elections at the world level has some revolutionary, you know, impact in these countries, I would say, in principle.
We're here in San Francisco. Somebody asked, do you think that San Francisco could play a role in the campaign for UN Parliamentary Assembly? Remember, San Francisco is where the United Nations Charter was written back in around the spring 1945. So how could the UNPA play a role, or how could San Francisco play a role with UNPA?
I think that literally everybody can play a role, and San Francisco as well, as a city with this symbolic, tradition. I would love to meet the mayor of San Francisco and talk with him about the subject and have him endorse it if he thinks he feels fit doing so, and I think that would have real symbolic weight.
We've been talking about wars. Somebody asked, is it possible for global warming rather than wars be a catalyst for international democracy?
I think there are different scenarios being discussed with regard to the consequences of global warming. And it is more complicated here than reaching a peace agreement, because it's in the end it's also about redistribution of wealth. And I would be personally a little bit skeptical that we would have such a constitutional moment as we had after these events I showed, like the Second World War specifically, because we here had, you know, a real change of the geopolitical power structure with clear, you know, victors and a clear situation. And as far as I would say, what awaits us in terms of climate change, sea level rise, all of the, you know, migration streams that would follow, and you know, the energy ramifications, all of this is that creates such a complicated situation that I would hope for a constitutional moment, but I am very skeptical. I mean, that would be a direct outcome.
You know, the United States was quite isolationist between the world wars. Somebody asked, for democracy to work, we need informed citizens. What system of communication does the European Union have that Americans could learn from? And would Americans pay attention?
I mean, you see, the project of a UN Parliamentary Assembly, and let alone a third democratic revolution, is, of course, extremely complex and has to do with, you know, political, cultural, social, and other matters, educational matters, as we now see. And that's why I think the piecemeal, the step-by-step approach makes most sense. And nonetheless, once a UN Parliamentary Assembly would be in place, we would have this you know, connection between the individual and the world level, which in itself would have some educational, you know, impact, because for the first time people would actually be called, or at least able to vote for a global representative. And today, only those people deal with international issues who in one way or another, you know, stumble upon it, come across it, because of their personal interests, their profession, whatever, their family and their background. But if everybody was called to elect a global representative, it automatically comes to the agenda sooner or later to think about what that means. And so, with regard to the European Union, I think one interesting development with regard to actually establishing some kind of European consciousness, and I believe that's where this question is heading, is that one of the innovations in the Lisbon Treaty is that there is now a citizens' initiative, which means that, you know, citizens, in effect, then civil society organizations, then they can collect signatures European-wide. And if they reach a certain number, I don't know it at the moment, the exact number, then the EU Commission and the Parliament have to deal with that question. So it's actually a first step in transnational, which is quite noteworthy, transnational direct democracy also. But otherwise, I think it's really a long-term process.
Speaking of long-term processes, and we're looking at the European Union as a possible model. Most of the people in Europe seem to be fairly well educated. The literacy rate is high, and it's fairly easy. The countries are not that large, and it's possible to travel from one to another fairly easily. Here in the United States, we have had members of Congress who have never been abroad, who have never had a passport. And so I guess there's a question such as this writer. To the best of our knowledge and experience, participatory democracy requires a citizenry with enough education and understanding to be able to recognize the long-term consequences of decisions that their government weighs. Do you believe this precondition is currently likely to be met? In other words, you have education and maybe understanding in Europe. What about in other parts of the world? Will the preconditions be available?
Yes, I mean, this is problematic in many respects. One thing I want to stress is the way such an assembly would have an impact on the system. It's a way to bring about systemic change. So I would expect, indeed, I mean, even if I don't like it, that at the beginning, the delegates in the UN Parliamentary Assembly would probably belong to the elite, you see. I mean, think alone about the problem of language. In a global assembly, Would we have the 5 official UN languages? Can we expect every representative to speak one of these languages? We can't. Only elites, the well-educated, are able to speak in one of these languages. I mean, if we think about rural areas anywhere in the world, you see? So this is problematic. But nonetheless, the point is that even if those people would be the well-educated, they would, you know, be rooted in their constituencies in a way. And they would bring about systemic change because they would be the elite, but they would represent different interests in that group, you see? So it would have systemic ramifications in the UN system. That's the point. But, of course, we should aim at having the broadest and, you know, most accessible kind of assembly possible. That's clear. But one has to admit it's problematic, and that's what I'm doing. What was the question exactly? I don't want to miss it. No. I think... well, it's fine.
Do the preconditions exist around the world?
Oh, yes. There's one more point I wanted to make. You see, in some of our conversations we have, and we are talking with a lot of people and organizations, you see, I made the point of we actually need to have such a dimension at the World Trade Organization as well. And then my counterpart in the discussion said, so you tell me that you expect elected representative from Ghana to understand what is going on at the World Trade Organization. So you can't expect that. But I think that's extremely paternalistic, and, you know, it was, of course, the Westerner who said that, because people, they also grow by their tasks, and we don't, and that's exactly the point. We don't need technocrats. We need people, you know, from everyday life who are there. They don't need to actually write the negotiations, but they have to look at what other people are doing there, the government representatives and the technocrats. We need real politicians in these areas, not ambassadors and diplomats. We need politicians, and whether they are extremely well educated or not, that's not the point.
I guess the question of education may arise here. Somebody's concerned that it's possible that the World Parliament will become less democratic and more autocratic. There have been democracies that, for some reason or the other, have become autocracies.
You see, we are already in a system that is autocratic at the global level. It's already there. There is no reason to have fear of some global, you know, autocratic system. It exists. That's the status quo. So would a world parliament make it worse? That's the question, actually, we have before us. You see, and so we already have it. And I believe that a world parliament would improve it. Because at least, the very least, what would happen is that we would have a more transparent process of how vested interests try to capture these processes, these negotiations. And I think that would be an improvement.
By definition, the World Parliament would make laws. Could you say anything about how the laws would be enforced?
I think there are two. This is interesting. I mean, this is very, very far in the future, and I don't know, actually. I don't know how that would happen, but I have an idea how it could happen. And the point is that in international law, we have interstate relationships, you see, and the predominant way of solving conflicts in the past was war through the military. This has limitations today. I mentioned it because the development of nuclear weapons makes war, you know, dysfunctional at the level of, you know, global power. So there needs to be some system of resolving conflicts. Otherwise, but that's a different topic, like covert operations and so on. But nevertheless, that's not what we want. And so in international law and in the international system, the historic way of solving conflicts and enforcement is war. You know, unilaterally just imposing the will on others, if possible. Well, but the point is that in world law, enforcement would not go through the military or through a war system, but through a policing system, because the building block, and actually the one world law is addressed to, is the individual. So world law would be enforced on individuals and not on collectives. It would be enforced, like, the most important development in this direction is probably the International Criminal Court. You see, the International Criminal Court tries individuals in their capacity as individual, and it does not, you know, try states or collectives or whatever. It actually deals with the individuals and what they are doing and their actions. And that's what's world law about. So it's also hopefully a way to get, you know, to depart from a war system and get into a system of police enforcement.
Well, here are two somewhat related questions. Turnout, voter turnout in the U.S. is dismally low. How would you encourage better international voter turnout? And who would vote for the UNPA and who would vote against it? Or which countries would be supporting it?
Let me start with the last question because that's the easier one. Well, at this time, there's not a single government in the world who's actively pursuing the idea of a UN Parliamentary Assembly for obvious reasons, you see. Because, I mean, we are dealing with foreign office, you know, like State Department representatives, staffers, bureaucrats. A UN Parliamentary Assembly would make their business more complicated. They would be accountable, you see, accountable to a global body. And that's something, if they can, you know, resist this as long as possible, they'll do it. So we have to actually have to look elsewhere, and we are dealing mainly at the moment with members of parliament, those who understand the issue, namely the members of those regional assemblies. And there is support in the European Parliament, in the Latin American Parliament, in the Pan-African Parliament, elsewhere in such assemblies. And this is at the moment more or less our starting point. I should mention nonetheless the Swiss government that has at least expressed some, they call it sympathy, you know, some, I know in English that's a little bit double-sided. They expressed their, you know, content with what we are doing, but that's it. It's a small country. The other question, how can we, you know, what voter turnout could we expect at the global level? You see, I mean, in the South, in the global South, people are extremely interested in having a voice and in actually, you know, go voting. So we have to differentiate. It's true that in Europe, in the West, there's some kind of, you know, apathy. Yes. But it's not only an apathy. It's, you know, it's no longer valued what is in place, you know. So, but just let me give you some figures that came from opinion polls on the question whether one would consider democracy as the best form of government, and you will probably be surprised to hear this, because in Africa and North, including North America, 87% said that democracy is the best form of government. They don't want to have anything else. In Latin America, 74, in the Middle East, 78, and the global average is 79% say democracy is the best form of government. So even though voter turnouts might be low, I wouldn't take that as a direct, you know, sign for apathy with democracy in principle. And in other parts of the world, it's simply not like that.
Here's a question that obviously is written by an American or maybe by any citizen. What would you need to build into the UNPA to assure that it is not corrupted by the corporations and big money?
That's extremely important. I mean, at the beginning, the body would not adopt binding regulations. But nonetheless, it would quickly become a target of lobbying once it came to that point. So maybe we can learn of what is happening at the national levels, like having, you know, registers, lobbying registers that you have to, register into as a company, if you actually take contact to members of parliament, such things might have to be developed. But I have to admit that this is something I haven't looked into in a sophisticated way yet, just because we are, you know, at a point where we are dealing with this very, very first step. And for sure, the point is that once we would have a deliberative consultative body, you see, it would be exactly the task of the representatives in this body to sort these questions out while they are not yet, you see, harassed by predators. They would have actually have to look into how to develop the body itself.
The role of religion. There are moderate religious leaders and there are reactionary religious leaders. What role, impact, if any, would religion play in the Parliamentary Assembly?
Well, I can only give you an intelligent guess, you see. I don't know how the future will work out. I mean, I could imagine, and this is really just intelligent guessing, you know, I mean, that there might be some, you know, groupings in the Assembly that have to do with religious belief, you see. But I would rather expect it to, you know, develop in a similar kind as in those regional assemblies, which means that political view would be predominant in grouping the representatives.
Unfortunately, there's time for just one more question. And out of all these, I'm not quite certain this is the $64 question, but who would pay for all of this?
Well, in the end, the taxpayer would pay for it. Of course, that's the case. And in the beginning, it would probably come from the UN's budget, which is, in essence, again, the taxpayers through the government contributions. But there could also be more innovative ways of financing the body, which means, like, which is the case in the International Criminal Court, that there should be provisions in the statutes that allow the body to accept non-state contributions. In the long run, it might even have, you know, international sources. Like in the European Union, you see, there is a development towards having genuinely, you know, European taxes. But that's, again, that's very far in the future, if it ever happens. And one other approach is actually to have civil society also strongly involved in this. I think it is key to understand that in the long run, if you, you know, make an overall calculation, there is actually a financial benefit on having the body. You know, of course, it needs an investment. But if you look at the long-term impact it might have on the war system and all that, you know, you know, in principle, countries would be able to, you know, save money in other areas and invest it better. And, you know, in proportion to what is spent on war and that, we are really dealing with a, you know, tiny amount for such an assembly.
Well, our thanks to Andreas Bummel from Mainz, one of the sites of the New Enlightenment, and I think Andreas has enlightened us on, while speaking on the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly and global democracy. We also thank our audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.